CITR Radio would like to remind you that this program is a three-dimensional color presentation. For quality sound and vivid imagery, please use your CITR 3D earplugs.
Hello, this is CITR 101.9 FM, located on the unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people, and you're listening to the final episode of CITR Docs Season 2. Over the past 2 months, we've been releasing many docs on the subject of community, and all the myriad expressions of community that that word can entail. Stories about Tibetan diaspora, gentrification in Chinatown, indigenous food sovereignty. You can find all past episodes in the CITR documentary series by going to citr.ca/docs or searching CITR Docs on Stitcher or iTunes. So this last episode of CITR Docs is called Truth and Reconciliation. It's produced by Lawrence Gatineau and James Mangi, and it's featuring Gennarji O'Sullivan. All of them are Co-op Radio mainstays. You can hear Co-op Radio by going to 100.5 FM, and it's always very cool to do this kind of collaboration with other stations. With reference to the upcoming documentary, it's hard not to view it from the context of what we're all thinking or talking about right now, which is Canada 150. And, of course, it is an in-vogue moment right now to be Canadian. I'm sure a bunch of people who are listening have had their American friends express envy about our current Prime Minister. What could be more innocuous than a celebration of the multicultural liberal paradise, Canada? But, of course, the colonial violence, mass displacement, and genocide of Indigenous peoples who have lived on the lands we now call Canada for time immemorial is the reality of Confederation. But let's let the documentary speak for itself. The question this upcoming piece poses is, how can reconciliation with Canada's colonial violence and the residential schools be achieved when the violence persists in other shapes and forms? Let's follow Gennarji's story and examine that question. Please enjoy.
Growing up, I was taught that Canada was a colony of Great Britain. I was not taught that the land had been taken from people who already lived here for thousands of years.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in Indian residential schools is a sad chapter in our history. Today we recognize that this policy of assimilation was wrong, has caused great harm, and has no place in our country.
I'm a certain kind of a person, an Aboriginal original, and though some may treat me like a criminal, I've had my chances. Chances my type rarely get. Not to worry. Don't you feel sorry as others appoint their form of punishment to those just like me? Just like me. We're never the same. Our type is different. A mysterious sort. Yet we are a threat. Always have been and always will be. I'm Gennarji O'Sullivan, previously known as Cheryl D. Williams. I'm a part of the 60 Scoop. I'm a part of the foster care system, a product of the ministry. And I am also a residential school survivor and an intergenerational survivor. I've also had to fight to keep my own children in my care. My 23-year-old daughter, Nimkesh, and my daughter, Aisha. So for me, a lot hasn't changed, you know, except for my behavior and my responsibility to my own experiences. I am a radio producer. We've been exploring the residential school era, and now we are talking reconciliation, because that's where we're at. I think I go through different phases when it comes to my identity, simply because of my varied upbringing. Not only am I a residential school survivor, but my mother went to residential school. In fact, her and I went to the same residential school. I started off in 1965, being born in the Alert Bay Hospital. My mother, who had gone to residential school, didn't have the capacity to care for herself or anybody else. She didn't have any parental values or family values because she went to residential school. So she basically gave birth to me and left me there. In 1971 or 72, I met my adoptive parents. And I was telling you a story about that, how I met them in a big house, which is our ceremonial house. There was a cruise ship that used to come into Alert Bay once a week all summer long. And on that cruise ship was a woman, and her name was Kathleen O'Sullivan. Kathleen O'Sullivan was a very eccentric Australian-Canadian. She came here in 1952 for the Empire Games. And she had created this relationship with the people in Alert Bay, the elders and the knowledge keepers, and it had encouraged them to hold common dances in their big house once a week. And throughout that time, she grew to love First Nations people along the coast, from the Clinkas to the Kwakiwaks to the Haidas, you name it. She loved us so much, she wanted to be one. That's how much she loved First Nations people. Anyhow, she had wanted to adopt a First Nations child for like a year or two. The elders in Alert Bay knew about her. They trusted her. And when the residential schools were going to be shut down in the 70s, they wanted to make sure that I was placed in a permanent house, that I wouldn't be fostered out. The elders in the community contacted Kathleen O'Sullivan, and they set us up to meet during one of these common dances in the big house, in the Alert Bay big house. And I wandered in with all the other children from the residential school and from the foster care home. And Kathleen was sitting with her husband, Gerald O'Sullivan, Gerard, who's Irish-Canadian. And I guess they were in their 50s or 60s at the time, a little old to be having children. But when they saw, I was wandering in with the rest of the kids, and I was sort of really super shy at the time. And I was kicking up the sand in the big house, following everybody else, and they all gathered around Kathy and Jerry, and they were yelling, "Kathy, Jerry, Kathy, Jerry, candy, candy." And they all had their hands out asking for candy. And when my dad saw me, he turned to my mother, my adopted mom, and said, "Look, we're a little old to be adopting a child, but if it was that little one right there at the end of the line, I would definitely say yes." And that's how I became to be an O'Sullivan. So they went through this transitional period where I stayed at the residential school and visited them for about a year or so. And then I ended up living with them for 2 years. And then when I was 10, my legal adoption went through. I'm a full-blooded Kwakiwak as far as I know, maybe a little bit Haida. But, you know, I didn't want to be Indian. I wanted to be white like everybody else. I wanted those blue eyes, you know, and the blonde hair. And I didn't want the tan that I had.
The government of Canada built an educational system in which very young children were often forcibly removed from their homes, often taken far from their communities. Many were inadequately fed, clothed, and housed. All were deprived of the care and nurturing of their parents, grandparents, and communities.
St. Michael's Indian Residential School was located in Alert Bay, British Columbia, in the northeast part of Vancouver Island. It was opened in 1929 and closed in 1975. In February 2015, Gunarji, along with her partner Gary Alver and her then 9-year-old daughter Aisha, attended a healing ceremony in Alert Bay to commemorate the demolition of St. Michael's.
That building embodies a lot of memories for people. Some of it they can't remember. Their bodies won't allow them to.
Do you think it should have stayed, or do you think you liked it gone?
Well, I think I have mixed feelings about it, because that building is a reminder of the history that the government upon our people.
That's sort of what I think too. Like, I have mixed feelings. I sort of like it because it's gone, and that sort of like saying goodbye to all of it. But on the other hand, it's like they're just trying to say, okay, we're going to tear it down. You guys are going to forget all about it, okay? Let's go. Move on.
Yeah, because the government doesn't want anybody to remember it. They don't want that evidence for anybody to see because they're so ashamed of it. And they know that what they did was wrong and that it was an act of genocide and it was killing the souls and spirit of our people one by one for generations and generations. And of course they don't want anybody to see it. And they think that if that building's gone and they can't see it, they won't be able to remember it. And 100 years down the road, that evidence will be gone, and that's exactly what they want.
Yeah.
They've managed to ruin a lot of lives.
Yeah. Love you, Mom.
I love you, too. I try to find ways to keep engaged with our culture, and right now I'm really concerned about the dynamics that the residential school, the legacy that residential schools have left us with. We've talked about how we no longer enjoy language and culture, but, you know, we need to explore how language and culture relates to the land. And the reason that is important is because we're in the midst of negotiating our land. And land rights and entitlement. And in order to engage in that, we really need to know where we come from, what land base and territory we actually belong to, you know, because we do belong to the land, right? And that's where our ancestors lay, in every blade of grass and every speck of dirt and every leaf. And the air that you breathe in that area is where our heart is. And that's where our soul is. And that is why land is so important. It's not about the money. It's about that connection. And I feel like residential schools have done their job in keeping us fractured. When the Oka crisis was happening, there was a lot of racism going on in mainstream media as well as other radio everywhere. It was fueling a fire of hate towards First Nations people. And I saw that, and that's what drove me, I think, to become the activist that I have become.
The Oka crisis took place between July and September 1990. The dispute involved the town of Oka, Quebec, the Sûreté du Québec, the Canadian Armed Forces, the Mohawk people, and a golf course to be built on traditional Mohawk land.
I was already involved with Co-op Radio. I would try to come to the station to get stuff on the air or news on the air, and sometimes people would say, yeah, by all means, come on in. Others would have more of a tighter format and couldn't really fit us in and things like that. But I started having this urgency, creating, oh, we got to tell people, we have to let everybody know. And that is also, I think, what drives me to do what I do too, right? So what happened was the Oka crisis was happening, and they had a vigilant city down there on Georgia Street, where they had tents up there who were there in support of the Oka crisis. But there was still a lot of anger that was being fueled and racism. And I used to walk past the vigilant camp and see all these people camped out and meeting and drumming and stuff like that. And I would kind of look at it from the outside. And one day, the Fire Hall Theater had put up this big stage in front of Robson Square for their yearly Dancing on Edge Festival. And I went, wow, why don't those people, thinking that I'm not one of them, why don't those people like use that stage for something, you know, like entertain people with thoughts and support the Oka people that way instead of ranting and raving the way they do. So I went in there and I talked to some people and I said, you know, exactly what I said to you. And they said, oh, you think so, do you? And I said, yeah. And I said, well, why don't you talk to the clan mothers? And I said, clan mothers, what are they? And they said, they're over there in that tent. And they brought me over and introduced me to the clan mothers. I told them what I thought they should be doing and why I thought they should be doing that. And they said, oh, well, if you really think so, why don't you just do it? And I was like, really, me? And they're like, yeah, you. I said, no, I can't do that. And they, oh, you can do it. It's your idea and it's a great idea. And if there's anybody that can do it, it's you. So I did. I called Fire Hall Theater. I asked them if we could borrow their stage and why. And they said, sure, by all means. And we hooked everything up. I can't remember when we did this big event, but it was an all-day event. It went from 1 o'clock till 11 o'clock at night. We were shut down by the police. And that was called a vigilance performance. And we had people from all walks of life who worked in theater, like the Spirit Song Theater Company. And we had Lee Miracle there, Gary Godfredson, who are literary artists. Even Margot Kane came out and she sang a song. And I never heard her sing before. It was called The Wind Beneath My Wings or something. And so that's when it really, my activism started for me. And actually that is when I got to full circle where I ended up wanting to be an Indian. Maybe I wasn't totally comfortable in my skin, right? Maybe there was a touch of self-loathing, but at least I wasn't on the wrong side anymore, right? I found my voice. I had tapped into what our struggles were. Instead of going along with people, like, what do you call them, the masses, which is where what I grew up in, instead of going along with what they thought of First Nations people and going along with what I had been brought up with, instead of running around thinking I'm better than them because I'm adopted and then I'm not one of them, that was a turning point for me during the Oka crises. Okay, now I'm one of them and I'm fucking mad, right? I went through this thing where I went from walking on the same side as First Nations people instead of why don't you do this? It's why don't we do this? And why don't we do that? I suddenly claimed my identity. But then I went through this period where I didn't like white people very much. And I became racist towards white people, towards immigrants. And all of these things started going around in my head because I was learning about all of the atrocities and how various people played these roles. And then I didn't like religion much either, and I was brought up a Catholic. And I wasn't that comfortable sitting in a circle lighting up sage or sweetgrass. So that's how I lived for a really long time, you know, not really taking either side. I don't want my children feeling hate. It doesn't feel good. It feels better to love and to give. And to be gracious, to be giving, and hate just doesn't fly, doesn't go anywhere, and it's counterproductive at this point. And so I've given up on hate, and I'm back to the center. My activism came out through my art, and that is how I've been portrayed as an activism. And many of us First Nations people, when we write poetry or do a play, it usually has something to do with a struggle that we have gone through, or say the poem might want to make a statement with that poem. And I think that's been my role, and a lot of the programming that I have done over the years has leaned a little bit more towards activism, because that is what is happening in our community. So it's almost impossible for me to be Native and not be an activist, and also to work in communication. So that has kind of influenced me a lot. I like to listen to people and I like to share stories, you know. And I think I'm not the only one. I think that there are a lot of us out there like that, just kind-hearted souls. So I think it's going to take a lot of time on our parts as Canadians when we're thinking about reconciliation. We just have to think with a good heart and just listen. And it doesn't matter whether you're working for the ministry at a radio station or in the educational system. It doesn't matter if you're a gang leader, you're a big dope dealer, whatever it is, you know, at least reconcile with people within your own workplace, you know. And if you're on the street, you know, and you're dealing to First Nations people, maybe not so much, right? Make sure that they're safe, at least if they're addicted. Or if they're working the street, maybe have their backs, you know. I don't know. I'm not trying to promote that either, but wherever you are in whatever walk of life, you know, just stand by First Nations people and get to know them and share your commonalities and some of your differences, you know. And if they do happen to open up to you, for God's sakes, have a listen. Don't be afraid to hear the truth, you know, because if they have for some reason opened up to you, that's something. That's really something. It's not easy. And they chose you to do that. There must be something there, right? Build on that. And you just keep building on it and building on it until you have this common ground and understanding.
While Gunarji's activism focuses on telling stories and communicating with people, her partner, Gary Oliver, thinks more is needed.
Yeah, my name is Gary Oliver, and my last name is Olver. It has no I in it. It's came from I was adopted to a British home. I'm an Aboriginal Canadian from northern Manitoba, from a small little reserve called Moose Lake, but I was born in Nepal. I was apprehended in the 70s, early 70s. And after that point, that's my parents were murdered. And so I didn't have a family to go back to. So even though that my one aunt wanted to adopt me as one of hers, but the government wouldn't allow that. So I ended up in foster care for a little while, and then I was adopted to a very nice British family that raised me right. There was lots of love, taught me from right and wrong, to be educated. But, you know, in itself, it had a lot of struggles, like when it came to spirituality. And, like, my parents were spiritual people. But they were Christians, right? And myself, I understood that, but I always knew there was more to it, right? And that was something they told me themselves. They couldn't teach me that, right? So that was something that I lost out. I've seen the struggles I went through myself, but I've also seen the struggles of other people and other Native people. And you know, I see where it all stems from. And it's like everybody likes to sugarcoat it and smooth it over and, with about reconciliation. How I look at it is the government really wants to reconcile with Aboriginal peoples in Canada. We need to get rid of the most racist law that was ever created, and it was like the framework for the African apartheid, and it's got to go. We need to abolish the Indian Act. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, it's the taxpayers that flip the bill for everything that happens to an Indian person, from being wrongfully incarcerated to apprehending their kids to, you know, calling them a loon or, you know, putting them in a mental institution because, you know, they see spirits. I mean, that's like part of their culture, right? The taxpayers basically are flipping the bill on that, you know what I mean? And it's wrong, and we shouldn't have a law like that in Canada, you know what I mean? It's like we go into other countries to help other people from genocide. So why isn't it our own people are seeing this? You know what I mean? It's everybody's like always complaining that, or our government's no good, or, you know, about all these other problems, but they need to look at it and say, you know what, as a people, we can change that law or abolish that law, right? Look at France. Every time they have a problem with something, they all protest and they change it. You know, sure, they pay half their, I think their net to, you know, to taxes, but if they ever get sick, they get doctors that'll come right into your home. They take care of you, right? You want surgery? It's done right away. You know what I mean? There's no wait time. So that's kind of how I look at it. It's like, I think as us, as a people, I've heard people that are creating sovereignty laws of the indigenous laws of their nations. And I think that's really healthy. And I think the government should push forward to help sponsor these people, to help, you know, those people learn about themselves and their laws. And then later we get rid of the Indian Act and, you know, the reserves would no longer be a reserve. It would be considered a municipality and there would be no more like little handout anymore that the, what they do now. And then that chief could be considered a mayor and they could turn to the federal government and ask for, you know, funding for their municipality. And they get a lot more and build infrastructure on those reservations. In return, that would put people to work on those reservations and give the young people hope, something to live for, right? It's like you can turn on the news, you know, now and you can see the suicide rates of Aboriginal kids. It's because you go to the reserve and there's nothing there. There's no work. And they just sit around and do nothing and they get on their, on the internet. And before you know it, they make packs and, you know, and they do these suicide packs and it's sick. I mean, they have no hope. So, you know, that all stems again from the Indian Act, right? You know, I think that's something that Canada should open their eyes and look at. You know, it's like, I'm proud to be a Canadian and I'm proud to be a Canadian citizen. And, you know, I was raised by Canadians and, you know, by a British family. And, you know, I've seen, you know, their point of view. And I've also seen, like, you know, don't get me wrong, I've lived with my own people and I've seen what they endure. And here I am. It's like I walk that fine line between those two cultures, between being an Aboriginal Canadian and being a Canadian, a non-Aboriginal Canadian, because how I was raised. And I see we can meet down that middle line there, you know, and I think that's what we have to do as Canadian people, and to reconcile the problems that we have here. You know, those laws were created by treaties, okay? And those treaties were signed because we were at war. That's plain and simple, we were, right? And it was a war that nobody could win. And that's the reason why treaties were signed. And this day and age, we're not at war, right? And why should that law, why should the law exist, right? We shouldn't be repressed or held back or anything else.
The Government of Canada sincerely apologizes and asks the forgiveness of the Aboriginal peoples of this country for failing them so profoundly.
Been given this great gift of communicating my experiences and other people's experiences. I've been given the opportunity to tap into major events that are happening in Vancouver, to grow with a community that has so much to offer, you know, from communications to theater, the performing arts, music, literary arts, you know. We have rappers out there who are all First Nations who never had the opportunity to share their gifts with the world because there was no platform. And that's why I've been so committed to Co-op Radio and community programming to the extent that I have been. I take it very seriously and always have. We have a lot of work to do, and that's what Truth and Reconciliation is about. It's about that work, and it's work. It's not easy. It's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of patience, a lot of understanding, a lot of listening, and a lot of talking.
Gunarji's poem, Aboriginal Original, is now almost 3 decades old, and it still resonates.
I'm not mistaken. I'm not mistaken. Some rights for you and no rights for us. Right? Right? Our questions are alive and so am I. Yet you continue to evade what we have to say. Should we all be like you? You, the man who takes all he can from Aboriginal girl to Aboriginal land. Aboriginal girl is still suffering. Mother Earth is hard to find. So, where do you stand? And where do we stand? You're standing on Aboriginal land. So, where do you stand?
This program was produced, recorded, and edited by Laurence Gatinel and James Mingy. Special thanks to Gennarji O'Sullivan and Gary Olver. The audio excerpt on the demolition of St. Michael's School was taken from the short film Demolishing Grief, available on YouTube and used with permission. The drumming you heard in this documentary was performed by the Heiwe Noku Drummers.
CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you to James Mangi, Laurence Gatineau, and Gennarji O'Sullivan for concluding the CITR Doc Season 2 series. You can find out more info about the series at citr.ca/docs, or hear past episodes by looking up CITR Docs on Stitcher and iTunes. Thank you to CRTC Radio Meters for partial funding of this project. Thank you to Poddington Bear for the opening music of the CITR documentary series. And thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this season, listen to our past episodes, or just listen to the season again. It's all there for you. And keep your ears to the ground. We'll be back in a few months with more locally grown documentaries. As always, stay tuned.